Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Benjamin Madley. He's Associate Professor of History and Chair of American Indian Studies at UCLA. Trained at Yale and Oxford, he's an historian of Native America, the United States, and genocide in world history. Today we're talking about his very important book, An American Genocide, the United States and the California Indian Catastrophe. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me on your program, Derek.
Well, thank you. So I would like to start by a quote that you use at the beginning of your book by Lucy Young, who said in 1939, an eyewitness to genocide, she said, "White people want our land, want to destroy us. I hear people talk about what Indian do early days to white man. Nobody ever tell it what white man do to Indian. That's the reason I tell it. That's history. That's truth." So, in many ways, that is much of the story of your book. Can you talk about that quote and lead into your work from there?
Sure. Well, one of the things that's amazing about her is all that she survived, and her survival is in a microcosm the miracle of California Indian survival. If there is a silver lining to the horrific events that are described in this book, it's that survival, the genius to accommodate, to hide, to resist, and to somehow survive against all but impossible odds. And she actually tells us quite a bit about her life and gives us a very rare window into the terrifying experience of being a California Indian person during these years of genocide.
I want to talk about the specific time between 1846 and 1873, which is one of the most, or it'd be most rapid, to use a soft term, depopulation in American history. But before we get there, can we talk for a moment about what California was like prior to the beginnings of European conquest?
California before the European conquest, which really begins with Spanish colonization in 1769, was an incredibly diverse place. Scholars think that 300,000 or more California Indian people lived in the Golden State, making it one of the most densely populated places north of Mexico in the years before Christopher Columbus arrived in this hemisphere. Just to give you some idea of how incredibly diverse this region was, and in some ways remains, we can think a little bit about languages. These hundreds of thousands of people spoke a dazzling array of languages and dialects. Pre-contact North America was already a diverse linguistic landscape. Indigenous peoples between the Rio Grande River and the Arctic Ocean before 1492 spoke somewhere around 300 separate languages that can then be classified into more than 50 different language families. Now, just to put that into context, linguists classify Europe's languages into as few as just three families. So amid indigenous North America's already varied linguistic landscape, pre-contact California stands out as one of the most linguistically diverse places on the planet. California Indian people spoke perhaps 100 separate languages classified by linguists into at least five different families of language, some as mutually unintelligible as modern Chinese is to the English language. So speaking these scores of different languages, California Indian people created dozens of cultural and political units. Anthropologists, from whose work I borrowed heavily, recognize at least 60 major tribes in California that can in turn then be divided into many more linguistic and political subgroups. For example, anthropologists have classified the Pomo peoples north of San Francisco's Bay into seven different subgroups, and the Yana peoples of the Northern Cascades, Southern Cascades, excuse me, into five subgroups. Ultimately, you can then divide all of these major groups into somewhere around 500 individual bands, given that each California Indian village or village constellation tended to act as its own political and economically autonomous entity. So the indigenous peoples of California were highly independent, but they were loosely bound to larger tribal groups by shared languages and cultures. They're also bound to each other by quite complex systems of exchange that distributed food, raw materials, manufactured goods, and luxuries. So it's quite a complex, diverse place. And while California Indian peoples did have violent conflicts with each other before contact, warfare does not seem to have dominated their lives.
And there's a couple things I want to say before we move on a little bit. One of them is that I live in Del Norte County, in Talawa Land.
Yes.
And I don't remember if it was in your book or if I just learned it somewhere else not very long ago, that the population in this county currently, I think, is about 30,000 or something, and the population pre-conquest in this county was something like 10 or 15,000. And this means, I mean, that's how fecund, which leads to the next question of, or next comment about how there were a lot of people living here, but they didn't devastate the landscape, that this 15,000 people were living here for, the Talawa have been known to be here for 12,000 years. So there were areas where there's really huge, fairly large populations who were still living, you know, pretty much by any definition, sustainably.
California Indian foodways and food systems were very complex. One of the ways that California Indian people all up and down the state managed to maximize the yields of the animals that they were hunting and the crops that they were gathering was through fire-based land management techniques. And that was true where you live in Del Norte County, for sure.
Well, the next thing that I want to mention before we move on a little bit is that I've read accounts of like what San Francisco Bay was like prior to conquest or early in conquest, where one Spanish explorer said that it was as though the bay were paved with sea lions, and there were so many whales that oftentimes, evidently, whales have what seems to us fairly bad breath, so there would be so many whales that their breath would stink. And in Northern California, you would see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes if you were by a river. And so do you want to say anything about the non-human fecundity before we move on?
So as in other regions of North America, the results of the fire-based indigenous game management programs that I was just mentioning deeply impressed European visitors. Many of them had never seen anything like this before. And these newcomers frequently recorded their astonishment at the variety and just the sheer number of game animals in California before colonization. One famous example, in 1759, the English navigator Sir Francis Drake described how at one point on California's coast, and I'll quote this for you, "Infinite was the company of very large and fat deer, which we saw by thousands, as we supposed, in a herd." This is quite famous. In the 17th century, in 1602, a Spanish explorer, Juan Sebastian Vizcaino, wrote that in the Monterey Bay area, there was much wild game, such as harts, like young bulls, deer, buffalo, very large bears, rabbits, hares, and many other animals, and many game birds. So these very abundant animal populations formed a cornerstone of life and the foodways for many indigenous Californians, not only in that pre-contact period, but right through the Russo-Hispanic period and well into the second half of the 19th century. And it's interesting that now federal agencies like the Bureau of Land Management and the United States Forest Service are employing California Indian people with that fire-based indigenous land management knowledge to more intelligently manage our public lands, which, as you know, have been quite ravaged of late by massive catastrophic forest fires.
So what are the, if you had to break the post-contact or post-beginnings of conquest history into segments, what would the segments be? And can you run through the ones up to 1846, and then we'll talk about that period in specific after, and then we'll talk about post that period after that. So what are the main periods of conquest?
So the first period of conquest, I would say, is 1769 to about 1822, and that's the period of early Russian and Spanish conquest. This is the time when the missions are established. The first one is built in San Diego in 1769, and the last one is completed in what is now Sonoma County in 1823. And these missions and the accompanying pueblos and the forts, the presidios, had a massive transformational impact on the coastal regions of California. So they were absolutely devastating for people like the Tipi from the extreme south, near the Mexican border, north into Pomo territory in places like Lake County. Many California Indian people did not come voluntarily to the missions, nor did they choose to remain in the missions voluntarily. These were also places of mass death. California's mission system took a terrible human toll. When the Franciscans concentrated California Indians and held unmarried females in locked, crowded, poorly ventilated buildings, the Monjarios, they facilitated the transmission of European pathogens, including those to which California Indian people had not previously been exposed, and the result was a demographic catastrophe. Infant mortalities were very high, and many people simply did not survive. And the Franciscans knew about this. By 1833, the Franciscans had baptized over 81,000 California Indians and buried over 62,600. And hardest hit were the indigenous peoples of the coastal zone between San Diego and the northern part of the San Francisco Bay Area. In 1769, this region was populated by, scholars estimate, roughly 72,000 indigenous people. And by 1830, that population had absolutely just plunged. So in total, if 310,000 California Indians populated the state of California in 1769, an estimated 245,000 of them were still alive in 1830, and by 1845, that number had plunged down to perhaps 150,000.
Wait, can you give those last two numbers again, please?
When the Spaniards first began to colonize California in 1769, scholars estimate that there were perhaps 310,000 California Indians living here. But by 1845, that number had plunged to perhaps 150,000.
And obviously, that level of, I believe you called it demographic catastrophe, has very strong social effects beyond simply the deaths. Can you talk about some of the effects of that on the some of the different Indian nations?
Right. Well, you can imagine what happens in your own community when large numbers of people were to suddenly die. In this case, traps were left untended, nets were not set out, hunting parties did not go out to hunt, gathering parties did not go out to gather, and social fabric was in extremis. So it caused a major social and political breakdown in many communities. But one of the amazing things about all of this is that California Indian people still survived and exist today. So despite all of this catastrophe, there are approximately 150,000 California Indian people in the state today. They belong to 110 federally recognized California Indian communities and more than 70 additional California Indian communities that are not federally recognized.
So let's move from the mission period, what was the period between the 1820s and the 1840s?
So during the period of secularization of the missions, much of the mission lands and their property are transferred from the Franciscans into the hands of private individuals, private Mexican citizens. But this does not mean that the demographic collapse is halted. In fact, it continues. Unfree California Indian labor provides the backbone of the labor supply for the state's ranchos, for its farm economy, and its grape growers. And this is not beneficial to California Indian people. They are very inexpensive labor, often held against their will, and they do not fare well as an overall population during this period.
So what happened in the 1840s?
So in the year 1846, the United States invaded California and took it by force from Mexico as part of the Mexican-American War. And one of the first things that the new military government of California did was to make California Indians into unfree laborers. They had to be very careful about the vexed question of slavery, which was already a major national issue in the United States in the late 1840s, but they found ways around that. And ultimately, the system was not unlike the system in the antebellum South. An employee, an Indian employee of a white employer, had to carry a certificate or a pass with them. And if they were found without that pass, they could be severely punished. So this really laid the groundwork, along with some particularly violent U.S. Army and U.S. Navy operations against California Indians at the time, to setting the groundwork for later much more extreme policies, the policies that began with the run-up to statehood in 1849, and it really took off in the year 1850.
So what do you mean by took off, and what are the policies?
So in 1850, state legislators convened for the first time in California, and one of the very first orders of business was banning all Indians from voting, barring those with one half of Indian blood or more from giving evidence for or against whites in criminal court cases, and denying Indians the right to serve as jurors in trials. California legislators later banned Indians from serving as attorneys. So in combination, these laws largely shut Indians out of participation in and protection by the state legal system. When you think about what this means, it amounted to a virtual grant of impunity to those who attacked them. That same year, also in 1850, state legislators endorsed unfree Indian labor by legalizing white custody of Indian minors and Indian prisoner leasing. 10 years later, in 1860, they extended that act to legalize the indenture of any Indian. These laws in combination triggered a boom in violent kidnappings. And these kidnappings, which also involved murder, separated men and women during peak years of reproduction. And both the killings associated with the captures and the separation of men and women only accelerated California Indian population decline. At the same time, many of these unfree laborers were treated as a kind of disposable commodity. Down here in Los Angeles, where I live, one lawyer of the 1850s recalled that L.A. had its slave mart, and thousands of honest, useful people were absolutely destroyed in this way. And he's not off the mark. Census takers in 1850 recorded 3,693 Indians in California. 20 years later, in 1870, census takers recorded just 219.
There's a couple of directions I want to go with this. One of them is that years ago I interviewed Alfred McCoy, who's written about the politics of heroin. And there's one line he had that always really stuck with me, which is that the CIA historically, like during the Vietnam War and other times, they did not actually, capital P, promote the trafficking in heroin, but what they would do is create zones where their local allies would not be, would have impunity, to use the word you used, would have impunity to traffic it. And so they would create enforcement-free zones. And basically, he said, when you create an enforcement-free zone and you combine that with an economic incentive, I mean, just think of the average person, I mean, just think if you or I or anybody else, and let's drop morals, we're given an enforcement-free zone that we can walk into any bank and say, give me all your money. I mean, of course, that's what a lot of people are going to do. So it sounds like one of the things that was created was an enforcement. We're going to go a step beyond enforcement-free in a moment. But what was created was an enforcement-free zone and economic incentive to kill and or kidnap the Indians of California.
I think you're absolutely right. And to take a step further, I would say that it is not an exaggeration to say that California legislators, with federal support, also established a state-sponsored killing machine, in large part because the federal government granted the state government impunity to do so. So California governors called out or authorized no fewer than 24 state militia expeditions between 1850 and 1861, and these expeditions were extremely lethal. They killed at least 1,340 California Indian people, by my count. Now, if you think that these militia expeditions were somehow rogue, they were not. State legislators supported them. They passed a trio of bills in the 1850s that raised up to $1.51 million to fund these state militia operations. And for your listeners, I would point out that $1.51 million in the 1850s is a great deal of money. It's the single biggest line item in the budgets for the state at the time. So by demonstrating that the state would not punish Indian killers, but instead financially reward them, these militia expeditions help to inspire vigilantes, the people who, in your words, are exploiting this zone of impunity. It encouraged these people, these vigilantes, to kill at least 6,460 California Indian people during the same period. Now, one of the things that this book reveals, I think, that's quite different from any prior research is just how heavily involved the United States Army and their auxiliaries were in this process. Sometimes they stepped aside, but in a lot of instances, they did not protect California Indians. And the research here reveals that they killed at least 1,680 California Indians between 1846 and 1873. They spent a great deal of money on this. At the same time, that Congress voted to reimburse the state of California almost $1 million to help them cover the huge expenses, the huge debts that they had incurred in launching those 24 state militia Indian hunting operations.
One of the things that I find most, and there are many, many things that are compelling about your book, and one of the things that I find most compelling, honestly, are the appendices. And it's understated but horrifying that, like, I look at Appendix 7, Reports of California Indians killed by U.S. Army soldiers and their auxiliaries, 1846 to 1873. I'm just looking at one page. May 15, 1850, Lyon's expedition, number killed, 60 to 800 plus. May 15 or May 16, Lyon's expedition, 3 killed. May 19, 75 to 150 plus. On or after May 19, 1850, Davidson's first dragoons instead of Lyon's expedition, Rancheria exterminated, 10 killed. Davidson's dragoons on May 19, 2, May 22nd, 5, May 22nd to August 26, 15. It's just this constant, and that was just for the ones with the auxiliaries and U.S. soldiers. You have others for civilians. You have others for, it's just absolutely, it's, for me it was devastating to just read the day after day after day massacre of November 17, 1857, 10 to 20, September 10th, 1 to 2, August 5th, 50 to 60. And that's just, for me, that was absolutely devastating to just see that every single day.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about how I came to this. First of all, I grew up not too far away from where you live, over in Siskiyou County, near a little town called Happy Camp on the Klamath River. And so I saw a lot of the continuing conflict between natives and newcomers there. My father worked as a therapist with local Karuk Indian people. And so I knew a little bit about the violence, but as I got into researching this book, which took me the better part of a decade, I was in Washington, D.C., and I had the opportunity to see Meyer Lin's powerful, heartbreaking Vietnam War Memorial on the Mall. And a couple of months later, still working on this project, I walked through Yale's Woolsey Rotunda, and I saw another record there of all the Yale men who had fallen in America's many conflicts. And I thought, walking through that marble hall, that Woolsey Rotunda space, that I wanted to create something like that for California Indian people. And this is maybe the first iteration of what I hope will be some others that might be more public that record all of those deaths. So that was the inspiration for this. I never knew that I would be able to find so many deaths recorded. The total in this book is 9,000 to 16,000 and probably many more. And it was very difficult to record these, sometimes looking at the microfilm or the old newspapers. The tears would come. But I'll tell you why I thought that this was so important. I thought about the people that I had lost in my life and what a major catastrophe each one of those losses was on a personal level for me. And then I thought about trying to record that and dignify the magnitude of human loss that this history represents. Not only for California Indian people, but for all humanity. All of the knowledge, all of the love, all that these people embodied who were needlessly and wantonly slaughtered.
Thank you for that. And I guess two questions. One of them is, if in some future iteration of this profound memorial, if it were put onto a map, how big is the largest space do you think there might be in California that did not have a marker on it for a massacre?
That's a good question, and I haven't actually used ArcGIS software to try to create such a map, but it's a very good question. I think that you would see that the map of California is spattered with these bloody massacres from the northwesternmost corner, Del Norte County, all the way down into the southeasternmost corner along the Colorado River and the border with Mexico. there were hundreds of massacres in which five or more people were killed in a single event in California during this period.
And isn't it horrific that we have to specify five or more, because there were so many that were, I mean, I've read accounts in your book, and I've read and elsewhere, of there are some that just have stuck with me for years since I've read about them, of, you know, we went in and killed three people. They were huddling, and they were huddling behind a tree. You know, they were simply hiding. They were, and it's just time after time, these massacres of people who, in many cases, are not fighting back.
The intent here, the genocidal intent, was only thinly veiled. I'll give you some of the really classic examples. In 1851. California's very first democratically elected governor, a man named Peter Burnett, who came down to California via Oregon, declared to the Senate and the Assembly of the State of California in a public address, and I quote, that a war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Indian race becomes extinct. Let me do that again, because I dropped that. So state endorsement of genocide was only thinly veiled here in California. In the year 1851, California Governor Peter Burnett declared that, and I quote, a war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Indian race becomes extinct. And the very next year, in 1852, United States Senator John Weller, who became California's governor in 1858, went even further. He told his fellow U.S. senators that California's Indians, and I quote, will be exterminated before the onward march of the white man, arguing that the interest of the white man demands their extermination. So we can see that at the very highest levels of political leadership here in the state of California, there were expressions of genocidal intent that were only camouflaged by the thinnest of rhetorical fabrics. The reason that these kinds of leaders felt they could make such statements was that there was a broad-based political and cultural consensus among white voters that the destruction of California Indians, their genocide, was not only acceptable, it was considered to be a positive activity to be rewarded.
Well, speaking of rewards, can we talk about bounties?
Sure. So, there are only a couple of places where I've actually been able to document bounties. And those bounties in California were offered by local communities. One of the most famous recorded head bounties was in the town of Shasta, which is just east of Redding, where I was born, and which is now a state park, very well-preserved Gold Rush-era village. And it is said that in the town of Shasta, a reward was paid for the decapitated heads of California Indians. There are a couple of other local bounties that were raised by private subscription further south in the Sacramento River Valley. But as far as I know, there was no state-sponsored scalp or head bounty in California in the way that there was in many of, all 13 of the original colonies had state-sponsored scalp bounties, as did many states in U.S. history. But as far as I know, there was no state-sponsored head or scalp bounty in the state of California.
Because I live in Del Norte, and because Yontaket is I don't know if you've been there, but it's an absolutely beautiful place.
Yes, I have.
And because I live so close to it, and because it, I want to tell one quick story about this that I haven't told publicly before, which is that when I moved here, I didn't know where Yontaket was, and I came at it from the back side, from the south side, just wandering through that area, and then the place haunted my dreams for probably a couple months, until I came in from the other side and realized that it was Yontucket. And the point is I didn't know anything about it, but it still was very, I'm not making any conclusions. I'm just saying that it haunted my dreams when I first walked through there.
Yeah.
But anyway, having said all that, so can you talk a little bit about Yontucket, which is not known as much as Wounded Knee or other massacres, and needs to be more known, I believe.
Right. So Yontucket is perhaps one of the larger massacres of indigenous people in the United States. This took place in the late fall of 1853 when large numbers of Talua Indian people from that region proceeded to Yontucket, which was then the largest of the Talua towns, near Yontucket Slough, just south of the mouth of the Smith River. This is a beautiful area now to visit of redwoods and open prairie. The Talua were coming there to rendezvous with Yurok Indian people from the south, from down the coast, and also with Chetcos and Winchooks and other California Indian people from the north. And they were coming as part of a spiritual pilgrimage, because Yontucket was and remains sacred ground. In fact, it is considered to be the center of the universe. So these spiritual pilgrims were coming to Yontucket to celebrate the World Renewal Dance, known in the Talua language as the Nidash, which means the feather dance, at the place where the world was born. And at this time, the Talua were not at war, but nevertheless, while the celebrants were praying and performing sacred dances and socializing, whites encircled them. They were led by a man from Crescent City named J.M. Peters. And Peters recollected what happened next as, I believe I'm correct in saying that he called it a Saturnalia of blood. It's one of those phrases that you come upon and do not forget. It's an interesting massacre from a researcher's perspective in that it's one of the few major massacres in California for which we have multiple different accounts that come both from eyewitness participants, people who saw the aftermath, and California Indian people. Most famously, the Talua man Sam Lopez and his wife and father-in-law talked about it, as did another Talua person named Eddie Richards. And Richards quoted an eyewitness survivor reporting that hundreds and hundreds of Indian people at Yontucket were there, and that when it was over, the water was just red with blood, with people floating around all over. We also have an account of this from a Talua woman named Amelia Brown, and some later oral histories come down to us. One of them comes from my friend, the tribal chairman of Smith River, and an historian and a dance maker, Lauren Bomlin. And he related famously a harrowing view of the massacre's conclusion, and he wrote, I'll quote this to you: "Over 450 of our people were murdered or lay dying on the ground. Then the white men built a huge fire and threw in our sacred ceremonial dresses and regalia and our feathers, and the flames grew higher. Then they threw in the babies. Many of them were still alive. Finally, they burned the village to the ground." Like in so many of the massacres that took place in California, many of the victims were incinerated or submerged or simply disappeared, making a complete body count difficult, if not impossible. In this instance, white sources, mainly perpetrators, estimate that as many as 150 people were massacred that morning, but this is probably an underestimate. Talua sources, the ones that I just discussed, which were recorded first in oral histories and later written down in the 20th centuries, insist that whites murdered as many as 600 people at Yontaket. So, even if we half that estimate of 600 people, Yontaket may rank among the most lethal of all massacres in U.S. history. But the amazing thing is that it remains all but unknown except to a few scholars, local residents like yourself, and, of course, the Talua people.
Another thing I find extraordinary about it is that it's, because it happened in historical terms fairly recently, the lineage between those who perpetrated the massacre and those who still hold power in this community is direct and namesake, such that some of the families who participated in that are still the families who own much of the property in Del Norte. And I'm guessing that in many of the eastern states that the land ownership would have been diluted or changed by then or sold off. But it's a direct link here. So we have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and we've sort of moved through 1860. Can you do like a just couple-minute version to bring us up to the present through massacres or through assaults, and then talk for the last 4 or 5 minutes about the Indian survival and resistance?
Sure. So beyond premeditated and systematic mass killings, other acts of genocide proliferated throughout this period from 1846 right through 1873. And these are important to acknowledge, I think. Many rapes and beatings occurred, and these meet the UN Genocide Convention's definition of causing serious bodily harm to victims on the basis of their group identity and with the intent to physically destroy the group. The sustained military and civilian policy of intentionally destroying California Indian villages and their food stores while driving survivors into inhospitable alpine regions also amounted to deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Further, if you think about it, because malnutrition and exposure predictably lower birth rates, some state and federal decision makers also appear guilty of imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, another one of the genocidal crimes specified by the UN Genocide Convention. Finally, the state of California, slave raiders, and federal officials were all involved in forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. In fact, scholars estimate that 3,000 to 4,000 or more California Indian children suffered these kinds of forced transfers. And by breaking up families and communities, it was a predictable thing to understand that these forced removals constituted also imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. So in effect, the state legalized abduction and enslavement of Indian minors, slavers exploited indenture laws for decades, and federal officials prevented U.S. Army intervention to protect the victims. Now, you asked about Indian survival and what's at stake here. The issues of genocide in California under U.S. rule obviously pose some explosive political, economic, and also educational questions, not only for state officials, but also for California tribes, the United States government, and individual California Indian people. And ultimately, I think that it's up to them, California Indians, not academics like me, to decide the best way forward. But I can present what I think are some of the major questions of policy and action and debate that this book raises. And the first one is really about apology and acknowledgement. And the question is, will federal or state officials tender public apologies like the ones issued by Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush in the 1980s for the relocation and forced internment of some 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II, many of whom, I might add, were citizens of the state of California, and many of them were interned in camps like Manzanar that were located here within the state's borders. So that sets a kind of precedent, I think, and reparations are a very important subordinate issue. Should Congress offer compensation? Should the state offer compensation along the lines of the more than $1.6 billion that the federal government has now paid out to 82,000 of these Japanese Americans and their heirs? These are big financial questions to consider. Another question, and this is related to the land, it goes back to your question about Jan Tockett and who owns land in Del Norte County, is should the state or federal government or private individuals return control to California Indian communities, like Smith River, of state lands where genocidal events took place? Commemoration is another important issue. Should the state build monuments at places like Jan Tockett? And the flip side of that is, should the state and federal government stop commemorating the supporters and perpetrators of this genocide, including people like Peter Burnett, the explorer Kit Carson, or the military leader John C. Fremont, who became one of the state's first two senators and who became the Republican Party's first presidential candidate? Fremont has a city named after him in the San Francisco Bay Area, many geographic features throughout the state, and lots of streets named after him. There are also educational questions. Will the genocide against California Indians join the Armenian genocide or the Holocaust in public school curricula or in public discourse? So these are all obviously crucial questions, but what's beyond doubt, in my opinion, is that the state and federal government should acknowledge that genocide took place here in California. And to wrap up, I'll offer my opinion about why this is so important. And I have three reasons I want to propose. First of all, decency. Decency demands that even long after the deaths of the victims, we preserve the truth of what befell them, not only so that their memory can be honored, but also so that we can deter the repetition of similar crimes. The second issue, though, is justice. Justice demands that even long after the killers have vanished, we document the crimes that they and their supporters have all too often successfully concealed, denied, or suppressed. And finally, as an historian, I'm particularly concerned with the truth. Historical veracity demands that we acknowledge this state-sponsored catastrophe in all of its varied aspects and causes, in order to better understand formative events in California, California Indian, Native American, and United States history as a whole.
That would be an extraordinary place to end, but I want to ask you one more thing.
Sure.
Which is, what can someone listening to this interview actually do to help advocate for that, the truth to come out about this? What do you want people who hear this interview to do?
Well, the good news is that we live today in the 21st century in a California that is vastly more demographically rich and democratic and participatory than ever before. So it is up to us as voters to write to our state senators, our state assemblymen, our governor, and to our federal senators and federal congressmen to demand action on this. But looking beyond California, if we can just for a moment, I think it's important for people to act in other ways as well. Only recently, peaceful American Indians were attacked, set upon by dogs. Peaceful protesters protesting the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, a project that threatens both people on the Standing Rock Reservation and in surrounding communities. So it's up to us in a democratic society to protect each other, and people at Standing Rock and the other peoples of the Dakotas very much need our support and help right now in the face of the huge threat posed by the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Benjamin Madley. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you very much, Derek.